What up, Primers? JC here. Can't get enough of Footy Prime the podcast? Why not head over to Footy Prime's YouTube? Head to youtube.com/footyprime for exclusive video content. Then make your way over to wearefootyprime.com for all things Footy Prime, including our official gear from Admiral and our One Ball Gin from Nickel 9 Distillery. And make sure to follow and subscribe across all platforms, from Twitter to Instagram to Facebook to TikTok. Footy Prime has got you covered for all things footy. Thanks so much for listening, and back to the show.
Oi, the boys on Footy Prime on occasion are known to use vulgarities and frankly appalling language, and sometimes tales are quite adult in nature. So keep the volume down if there are kiddies around. And thank you for listening.
You're listening to Footy Prime News and Such, your one-stop destination for footy news and such. Footy Prime, your almost daily footy fix.
The weekend is here, or nearly, and in 4 years' time, the World Cup will be here in this country. How amazing is that? Welcome to Footy Prime. I'm Brendan Dunlop. Happy to be joined, as always, by our two former Canadian international superstars, Craig Forrest and Jamie Brennan. Well, you don't believe that, Craiger?
Well, superstars, it might be a stretch. But thank you.
For you, stretchy arms, or was that a shot at Jimmy?
Well, that's a good point.
Well, how do you guys feel today? How are you excited that we can now change the term "it's coming home" because it has new meaning? It is coming home to our home.
It's unbelievable. You know, it is actually unbelievable when you think about, where we started, youth soccer players and even coming through the national system. And when we played, even, talking about could we ever win a World Cup bid or be part of a World Cup? Not a chance. And then we started naming stadiums and, where are we going to play? You know, going to play at Varsity, going to play at Centennial Park. Like, it's embarrassing, right? Like, And then here we are in a situation where we've got, it's unfortunate for Edmonton, but just the same, Vancouver and Toronto, and, to be able to host as many games as we are, it's like having multiple Super Bowls, in our country, which is just absolutely fantastic.
Anything to add there, Jimmy?
No, I agree with him. Yeah. No, listen, we've been talking an awful lot about this, and never – in all our years, did we think that this was going to happen, that we'd be hosting a World Cup. And it is a dream come true. And this is only going to create a bigger demand for our sport in this country. And hopefully off of the back of this, our domestic leagues continue to grow and get better and stronger. And we continue to develop more players and get more people involved in the game at the grassroots level.
I think we have an awful long way to go. But my bet is, when we go to 26, 30, 34, I think in 2034, this country, the landscape in football is going to be significantly different, because I see us qualifying for the World Cup every time now. So I think that momentum and everything else will build, because at the moment, I still think I can't consider us a soccer nation at this moment, but we're getting there.
Interesting. Well, we'll get into all that. To Jimmy's point about, getting more people involved with a beautiful game. It is a Friday show when we like to get people involved. We like to speak to a writer or a scribe or someone smarter than us to some extent. So today, very happy to bring on Alexander Gongu-Rozek from One Soccer, the Canadian Premier League, and Between the Sticks. Alex, welcome to the show, man.
Thanks for having me. It's a pleasure to be joined with you fine gentlemen on this Friday. I mean, this is... lots of vast knowledge and a pretty good group of people to talk Canadian soccer with. So I'm pleased to be amongst this group.
You know, he was lying there when he said these fine people.
Fine gentlemen. What?
Fine gentlemen. That's a lie.
Distinguished.
Who did you think you were on with, Alex? Who did the producer say you were going to chat with today instead of us?
I don't know. I got some calls about five-star hotels and.
Yeah, I love your work, Alex. Really do like what you put out, buddy. Your content and your analyzing of stuff is absolutely top drawer.
Thanks. Very good. Appreciate that.
Yeah, man. We've wanted to talk to you for a while. It's been great to see your work and now to see more of it on One Soccer and that. You are based in Vancouver, so thank you for joining us in what is earlier in the morning for you. And it's is that sun that I see peeking through there? It's sunny in Vancouver. I didn't think that happened.
Me neither. I kind of forgot what it felt like. But I think the conclusion I've come to is that, you know, maybe the World Cup gods blessed something on Vancouver. Finally, the announcement, no coincidence. It was rainy all day yesterday. As soon as it hit 2 o'clock and the announcement happened, it got sunny. So maybe that was the ominous sign that Vancouver needed.
Mm. Perfect.
But there is maybe one soccer god, like, actually, that you can label and you can see, you can shake hands with if you're lucky. I think that's Victor Montagliani, because 4 months ago, the prospect of World Cup games being held in Vancouver in 2026 wasn't even on the table.
No, that's what's biggest, the miracle about all this. You look at just the timeline of how 4 years ago they pulled out, and it just kind of felt like, okay, it's over. You hear rumblings like, oh, they want to get back in. It's like, yeah, of course they want to get back in. It's too late. When is FIFA ever going to reverse a decision like this? And then I guess, you know, it's 2020, it's 2021, it's 2022. You're like, okay, no chance. You hear still more rumblings. You're like, okay, why are they wasting their time with this? It feels like it's over. And then all of a sudden, everything just kind of comes together. You hear FIFA is talking to Vancouver. Vancouver's talking to FIFA. It feels a little more real. They come together. They you know, come to some sort of agreement. And then all of a sudden, it was just wake up. I think it was April 16th. I just remember the date because I was researching yesterday. All of a sudden, Vancouver's back in. And then not only that, they go from maybe they get 2 or 3 games to reports suggesting as high as 6 games, more than Toronto. Obviously, Edmonton no longer in the running. That's one heck of a comeback, really, is how I'd describe it. Not one I'd expected, but shows how quickly things can change in this sport.
Yeah, I didn't either, Alex. And I have to think that Victor Montagliani played a big part of that as well. I know he was pushing the provincial government, the government in Vancouver, to get into the bid. He was disappointed that they didn't get it initially. And you're right. I think I was surprised myself. I thought it was too late. They left it too late in the game and it wasn't going to happen. So I think what helps them, Vancouver, BC Place is about the closest we have to a turnkey stadium in Canada, other than the grass situation, but they've got that solved. It won't be a dead system. It'll be an actual live system. So they guarantee that will hold up for the amount of games that they have. So all in all, logistically, geographically, Vancouver's in a great spot, you know, with like Seattle, San Fran, Los Angeles also come into play. And I know FIFA look at that as well.
I think it's the best right now in terms of the World Cup cities. It's one that you look in terms of infrastructure now, I think it's the best. I think in terms of, because you look at what the cities offer. I mean, Edmonton, great venue. It's old. It needs a lot of work. It needs the grass. It's a bit outside of downtown, having visited for the November games. Like, that was a bit of an annoyance. You look at Toronto, you know, great stadium, just small. It's, you know, you look back to how the fact it was always a temporary stadium in the first place and how tough it is to build renovations, location a bit awkward. You look at Montreal, maybe Montreal has potential in terms of where the Big O is located. But as we know, that thing's just a rickety dust heap. It needs a lot of work as well. BC Place doesn't need that work. It's in a great location. The city has hosted these world-class events before. It's got great transportation. Everything about it's, you know, great. It's just really, like you mentioned, the grass situation, which is a little easier to stomach than, say, looking at Edmonton, you need to heavily renovate the structure. You look at Toronto, you need to build the structure so it even gets big enough for a World Cup. You look at Montreal, it does make sense in terms of it being the best city. So maybe that's kind of why things happen. I don't think if this was Montreal coming back in, it wouldn't have worked, because they would have been like, well, you need to fix a lot of things. You need a lot, to ask. Whereas Vancouver, it was already always kind of ready for an event like this. But since they pulled out, it was kind of an afterthought. And I think it shows based on how things have gone from zero to supposedly 6 so quickly.
Yeah. What do you boys make about those rumors that Vancouver would host 6 games? Obviously, we knew that there would be 10 games in Canada. We thought that would be spread over 3 cities. One American city, you can pick which one benefited. There's 11 U.S. host cities now for these games, which is one more than we'd expected. But if they don't split it down the middle, 5 and 5, Jimmy, that seems strange, especially for Toronto, doesn't it?
It does. You'd think so. I'd be disappointed, obviously, living here in Toronto and just how multicultural and diverse this city is as well. And, it'd be disappointing if we didn't split it and go 5 and 5, and lose a match. I think it would upset a lot of people here.
I don't think it has anything to do with, you know, Toronto over Vancouver. I think it comes down to just logistically and the groups where they're situated. They want to keep the travel to a minimum. Mm-hmm. And that comes into play. But I don't think it has anything to do with, you know, Vancouver and Toronto. So I could care less who has four, who has six, who has, if they have five of five, really could be quite honest with you. I think it's just all great.
I care.
Yeah. Look at this guy playing on the
What do you mean
guy.
You care? You went to the World Cup in the U.S. every 4 years.
Yeah, I did, actually.
Yeah.
And I got some positive feedback from that, so have that.
Oh, yeah.
People said, great idea. Great idea.
Yeah. How many of them had Kroenke in their last name or anyone that's on the bill there to make billions because they own the stadiums? Any of those feedback emails, Jimmy?
No, nothing from them yet.
No, not that from them yet.
Yeah.
No.
Yeah. Europe doesn't have enough stadiums to, you know, hold multiple country World Cups, do they, Jimmy?
No, you might as well host, what, five of them together, make it work.
Yeah.
Or just do one. Yeah. Plain and simple.
If you missed our last show, Alex, or for any listeners who didn't listen on Wednesday, Jimmy had this great idea that for future World Cups, every World Cup from here on out after this one should just be held in the United States. To limit
the Gold Cup, basically.
Yeah, like the Gold Cup. Except it'd be a little different when it's Guadeloupe turning up in Cincinnati. Not Guadeloupe turning up in Cincinnati. But I saw the point, Jimmy. I understood that. But
makes
I like this traveling roadshow. No, I'm happy to – every 20 years, the States should host a World Cup every 20 years. And from now on, they can't ever again host it solo. It has to be shared. Mm. They have to share it.
One thing we do know, guys, I mean, it's getting almost to a point where it's impossible for one country to host it other than a few. There's very, very few that can host it on their own. And it's so big. And I think 2026 is the first time that FIFA actually take over the event, the federation and the association, the Canadian Soccer Association, U.S. and Mexico have nothing to do with it. Peter Montopoli was Canadian Soccer Association employee. He jumps over to FIFA. Canada's committee. Yeah, there will be one in Mexico. There'll be one in the United States as well. So they'll look after all that. But they're actually employed by FIFA now. And when that makes sense, it's such a massive event. You can't possibly rely on a non-profit, you know, association to be running an event this big.
Yeah, 100%. I agree with you on that.
That makes sense. Alex, you made a point about Vancouver that stood out to me, saying that you thought it was like the best host city of the lot. Obviously, the stadium you highlighted at that point. But maybe what are some other things that that make Vancouver such a great host in your eyes?
Yeah, I mean, first of all, I guess it helps having seen big events come through the city. Like the Olympics was, you know, special to see what the Winter Olympics meant to Vancouver. Then the Women's World Cup, as well as the final. How the city rallied around that. I thought it was, you know, fantastic buzz and the city. And I just think it's set up so well for, you know, it's a big multicultural city, just the way the downtown is, the stadium being downtown, how it can kind of create a bit of a hub, you know, for people to rally around. You look at just due to those aforementioned events, we got great transportation now from the airport, et cetera, hotels around the area. And then you just talk about Vancouver itself. We know the beauty that it brings in terms of the beaches, the water, the mountains. I think that'd be a fantastic backdrop for a World Cup. I mean, you're looking at cities you want to visit. You come to Vancouver, you're watching soccer games, but it's not just that. It's like, you know, you're going to the beach, you're enjoying the city, or you're getting the food, you're going to the mountains. Yeah. There's a lot of cities. I mean, there's not a lot of cities that offer that. I mean, we're looking at just off the top of my head, I'm thinking of a city like Boston and how they're using the New England Revolution Field that's like an hour outside of Boston. Like, that's not exactly going to be a sexy draw to go out in the middle of, what is it, Foxborough to go watch games, and you're just kind of stuck out in the middle of there. Whereas you come to Vancouver, you're at the game, I don't know, Canada, say Ecuador at 7 p.m. and then 9 p.m. the game's over. You just walk over to the beach or walk over to a pub. It's not, you're not stuck.
Or drive down to Seattle and get on the I-5 and go watch a game in Seattle.
Yeah, exactly. And you've got that proximity. You've got all of those factors. Because of that, I think it kind of gives it an edge.
And Seattle is very similar setup to Vancouver, how you just described too. Great stadium, right downtown. And that city is incredible. I was there for that MLS Cup final. Toronto FC's lost there. And the city had changed a lot since I'd been there a few years before. Really cleaned up and gentrified downtown by that stadium district.
you know, even historically, you know, look at Seattle and Vancouver, two fantastic football soccer cities, you know, historically. Mm-hmm. You know, go back to the Vancouver Whitecaps. And when I was a youth, you know, young 10, 11-year-old going down to the Kingdom and watching games against the Sounders and, you know, and chanting Whitecaps across the stadium and just, but you know, so both cities are really have a rich history, and Seattle has always been amazing. Yeah. And when they came into Major League Soccer, they, it was an absolute slam dunk.
But don't forget about Portland as well. That whole area up there with Vancouver, Portland, Seattle, they're the diehard football fans. They love the game.
Mm-hmm. That's great. Yeah, I mean, to not see, there's a few cities that aren't hosting, which I think feels weird. If I'm an outsider, if I'm just a Portuguese guy, and to see a World Cup hosted in North America and not see Montreal, Chicago, Vegas hosting, I think that's, you know, in hindsight, looking at it now, that feels a little weird. I understand for all of them. I mean, Vegas wouldn't have even been in the picture 4 years ago when they'd announced this, right? They didn't have that NFL stadium, or had, you know, hadn't put shovels in the ground at least by that point. And I understand why for Montreal, you know, it didn't work. But as a Canadian, I'm disappointed. I think Montreal is an amazing part of this country that I would have loved the world to see. Wonger, I know you're incredibly biased on that as well, for good reason. So
play yes, it. I am.
Play it, McGill.
Yeah, play McGill. Could you imagine?
That would be fun.
Just the idea of them. Imagine the city hall conversations about how to divide the money, to pour the money into saving the Big O or revamping the Big O. Like, no one wanted to have that conversation. That's why they didn't even put a formal bid in.
That stadium has been a nightmare since 1972. Oh. Never finished. Mm-hmm. Never worked properly.
No, wild.
Absolutely wild. Terrible. Still doesn't. Hey, Alex, I got to ask you, what are your thoughts on this team at the moment, what they went through over the last couple weeks? Did you get any feel in Vancouver that there was a, you know, a bit of tension? Were the fans really, really disappointed? Were they still sort of backing the team, or is that kind of split a little bit?
Yeah, I feel like it's very mixed in the sense that I think most diehard fans, they understand the realities of what's going on. I mean, we've kind of mentioned, I mean, everything that happened this week isn't anything new. Say, it's not the first time that we've seen, you know, the players call out the CSA, or the, you know, there be any sort of disagreements with the CSA. It's happened in 2019 privately. It happened, you know, in 2009 publicly. There are several other instances where it's happened. So I think for anyone who's been following the sport, following the program, they know the fractures, the growth that still needs to be done, et cetera. I think it really hurt the casuals 100%, because for them, they come in, most of them during this World Cup qualifying round, understandably so. You see, you hear all this Alphonso Davies, you hear they might actually go to a World Cup. It's, you know, it's all on TV. You get these millions of views. You start following them, you think everything's rosy, you think everything's great, they're going to go Qatar, yay. So when you see something like this, yes, it's disappointing for a casual fan who might not know what's going on. And I think that's kind of reflected, say, just for the Curaçao game, for example. I was only 17,000 fans. That's a lot of diehard fans who are there, but I don't think, if you read online, many of the casual fans were hurt. They were annoyed. They didn't necessarily understand what was going on. And I think if you look, that was the biggest split, in the sense that if you're involved in this, you know, say discussion, be it if you're a hardcore fan, if you're media, if you're the players, you kind of have seen these fractures and see why these sort of discussions and negotiations are important, and, you know, what the players' view is on it, what the federation's view is on it. But I understand 100% the casual fans, how they might feel alienated by that. And because of that, it made for such a weird mood. I think Vancouver, when these games were first announced, we saw how quickly the tickets for that, you know, now canceled Iran game went. People were excited to have the national team back. It was a big deal. Like, okay, they're in a World Cup now. Then basically by the end of it, it was, you could feel the anger, the apathy, the resentment a bit. And it's kind of disappointing, because Vancouver always loves the men's national team. They've always shown up well for it, but just felt like the events of these last few weeks really caused a split, a division. That's a good way to put it, Craig.
Yeah, I think the neutral fan, I think they're in a, you know, they've witnessed many sports and labor disputes and rich sportsmen battling for more money and all this sort of stuff. And it just gets, it gives them a bad taste. It really does for the neutral sports fan. And that's disappointing. And that's why I really thought that they should have probably played the game. However, they certainly have ruffled some feathers in the CSA because they are in damage control right now and trying to figure it out and trying to make some forward steps, which is great. So I'm not sure that would have happened, Alex, if they didn't cancel the game. I don't know what you think about that.
Well, that's it. With the players, I 100% back what they did, their idea. I mean, it's effective because it's like you want to send a message. There's no better way to send that message than canceling the game. On the other hand, I also 100% sympathize with fans in the sense that, you know, it is 2022. Could the players have gone on social media and at least put out some sort of statement or some sort of message earlier? 100%. You see it all the time. It's an effective way to go about things. You're telling me Alfonso Davies and 3 million Instagram followers isn't a way to reach a market or some of the other players. You know, it's 2022, so I get the fans' point. But in terms of sending a message, the message was certainly sent because it's, again, it's not often you see a game canceled in that regard. So obviously they felt it had to be done. And, you know, now we'll see, you know, long term, because I think at the end of the day, long term, everyone wants the same things. I think, you know, we all want a healthy sport in this country, want both national teams to be compensated fairly for, you know, we want them to succeed at both of their tournaments. We want two good domestic leagues or one together. We want men's and women's players playing professionally. We want all these great things, but, you know, sometimes you need kind of a trigger to kind of get the wheels going. And maybe last year, the women's Olympic gold medal kind of got the wheels turning slowly. And now the men's make the World Cup, things are just getting faster and faster. It's like they mentioned, you got to make sure that growth keeps up, because all of a sudden, 3 years ago, 4 years ago, you're 130th ranked association. There wasn't a domestic league in your country. The sport is an afterthought. You just have your three MLS teams. All of a sudden, you're starting to put all these infrastructures together. You've got to make sure that you're financially set up, that you're as an organization set up. And I think maybe this strike was kind of the trigger that all the parties needed to come together, because we saw what it did. I mean, we saw how it opened up the negotiations between the men's and women's side, how it opened up negotiations between the players and the federation. So now everything's kind of set into place. It's just about finding a solution, and hopefully it's one that benefits everyone.
Yeah, I think you're totally right there, Alex. And when, you know, it first came out and people jumped all over the money, and obviously Bontas came out saying, look at the numbers they're asking for. This is untenable. This wasn't about the pay raise. That was just one thing. These players were looking for a revolution for the whole setup, not just, you know, a pay rise for this World Cup bonus money. So obviously something that's been a long time coming. And, there's several things there that should have been addressed a long time ago. But I agree with you that I think this is the trigger to finally get that going. So that in itself is exciting. We'll finally see some of this change. And I think there'll be plenty of it. You were at that Curaçao match. A lot's been made about the fans. I think it's quite unfair to Vancouver, considering all that had happened for those 2 weeks. But what was that, the vibe like in general there? They obviously did the business on the field, but what was it like covering that match?
Yeah, it was a bit of a weird one because, again, it was a good... To be fair, I think considering the circumstances, it was a good crowd. The whole 17,000 last minute, I thought they were louder. I think in terms of the tickets itself, it was a good lesson. Personally, I think for Canada soccer, just because you qualified for a World Cup doesn't mean you can price fans out at $60 a ticket for Curaçao on a Thursday night. That's just not realistic. And I think, you know, yes, you went however many dollars the tickets were for Jamaica at BMO Field, but it's one thing to qualify for a World Cup for the first time in 36 years. It's another thing just to play a routine Nations League game against an opponent that, I mean, I love what Curaçao has been doing, and I think they're super underrated. I don't think, you know, average Jimmy or Joe from down the street are 100% aware of what's going on with Curaçao. So I think because of that, it was a bit unfortunate because it felt like that atmosphere was kind of hanging over. You could see the discussions on Twitter. You could see the discussions like, oh, what's up with this crowd? But in terms of itself, once the game kicked off, the players did their thing. The fans did their thing. It felt normal again. It really did feel normal again. It was just after everything that had gone on that week, all this, you know, press conferences, negotiations, players not speaking to media, et cetera. Mm-hmm. It just felt nice to see them go out, do their business, do it in style, see Alfonso Davies back in a Canada shirt, score some nice goals. and just kind of get that good vibe going again. So I think in terms of the
Curaçao game, we knew, I mean, before the game even happened, it was the softest game as far as ticket sales go. Do you think, Alex, that has to do with a little bit, like, what is this Nations League? Like, do people understand it? I mean, we don't even quite grasp all of it, you know, and it is so new and there's so many different, it's so fragmented. And what are they playing for now? And why is this Curaçao game important? And, you know, it's very confusing. Mm-hmm.
I think so. I think that's fair. That's the thing with the international soccer market right now. To a casual, it's you know, you hear all these things like friendlies and Nations Leagues. It is a bit confusing to understand. Like, even the, I'm sure some people are wondering, why the heck are they playing in Iran or a Panama just because? Like, is it, you know, that's the weird thing about, I guess, soccer supposed to an outsider, this whole idea. But I don't think it had that much of an impact on ticket sales. I think people would grasp to the concept, they would warm to the concept. I think back to 2019, I think Canada, they got, I think it was 18 or 19,000 at BC Place for French Guiana in a Nations League qualifier. So something that meant even less, but just because tickets were cheap. So for me, that was the bigger sticking point, I think, than opponent, than anything. It was just the ticket prices. Like, you can't do $60 unless, you know, Lionel Messi is coming through the building or something, like Portugal, or, you know, even a top team like an Ecuador is coming through the building. You can't be charging $60. And I think that was the bigger reason, less Nations League. I think people, the Vancouver crowd is a smart soccer crowd. They're always there for the moments. They understand, like, when it's playoffs, when the Whitecaps are in a big push, they'll show up. But it's more those small games. It's more those Wednesday nights that have always been a struggle. It's more those, especially when it's $60 like it was for this game.
That's a good point. And you labeled Vancouver there as a smart soccer crowd. And I think that, you know, Toronto is a very much an event city. And you referenced the Jamaica prices, which I think were, what, the cheapest ticket was $120 maybe to get in, which for, you know, just to compare to TFC, I think you get in the South End for $20 still. So understanding that people would turn up because it's an event and Canada Soccer could, you know, turn some much needed gate revenue, they raise the prices there, but you got to take that hat off and look at the individual market and the setup. And just because they want to believe that the Nations League is important, it's going to take some time before the people do, right?
That's it. You got to be careful, right? Because it's like, you can believe one thing, but I think it was a good lesson for them in that sense that Canada, maybe if, you know, if we're talking about Canada being a soccer country, maybe if it's a soccer country, they'll play Grenada and they'll get 50,000, but we're not quite there yet. And I think this was a great reason. And even then, you look at soccer countries, I always see it all the time. I mean, Portugal, you'd know well, Brendan, don't they sell tickets for like $10-$20? Like, when they had that World Cup qualifier back in March, it was like $20 a ticket. Like, if Portugal's doing that, why should Canada be pricing their fans out? I don't get why Canada and the US love to shoot themselves in the foot that way. It really feels unnecessary. And you always hear reasons, like in the US they love to do it so they can try to dissuade opposing fans. Canada, I guess it's more, you know, just revenue. It's for those reasons. Teams in Europe, if Portugal, they have the players they have, if they're charging $20 a ticket for a must-win World Cup qualifier, like, I think they're doing something right in that case.
One thing I do think is great that CONCACAF have canceled the Nations League for September, where Europe are still playing Nations League matches in September. So that gives them that one opportunity before November to, you know, get a feel and get a good profile team that can challenge them. Because this last window against Curaçao and Honduras, unfortunately, you're not going to play in a monsoon in Qatar. That was a waste of time from that. And Curaçao basically put 11 men behind the ball. That's not happening at the World Cup either. So, you know, you're not trying to break down Belgium on top of the box. Let's face it. So from a standpoint of what they got out of those games, I'm not sure, Jimmy, whether you think that they got much out of that or it was more on the training pitch with John Herdman.
Yeah, no, look, we had this discussion. At those two games, they got absolutely nothing. For me, there was no preparation that's going to prepare you for a Croatia, a Belgium, a Morocco, especially down in Honduras. It was a waste of time. For me, I felt the game shouldn't even been played. This should have been called off. I thought it was dangerous, especially the way the players were sliding all over the place. And
there's just not enough dates in the calendar to load, Jimmy. Yeah. You know, you look at the U.S. and the El Salvador the next night, same sort of thing. But they got no dates. They literally were saying, God, unless this is a swimming pool, we got to play it.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And it near enough was a swimming pool.
The pictures from that El Salvador game were insane. Yeah. Absolutely insane. Alex, let's finish on this, man. I saw you did a profile on the U20 team that's heading down to qualify for the CONCACAF championship there. What do you think of this U20 team? Craig mentioned it in this show, and it said a few times, you know, after this World Cup now, Canada will never again not qualify. The future looks so bright. So tell us about this U20 team a bit.
It's fantastic to see how it's come together. I mean, it's just the growth has been staggering. I compare 2018 when they had the qualifiers. I think it was something like 15 or 16 players in MLS academies. Pardon me, geez. Most of them kids who'd never played it professionally. They just kind of kids in academies. Of course, you're going to struggle when you go out and you're playing Honduras. What is Honduras? Usually it's 20 people playing in their domestic leagues at 18, 17, 19. You know, you're playing Costa Rica, same deal. Even the U.S., at least they have a bigger pool, you know, kids playing in MLS, et cetera. Canada didn't have that before. You look at their team now, it's night and day. I mean, first you got the six CPL players, which is players playing every week in the CPL professionally against men. Massive. You look at the I think it's eight MLS kids. Most of them, they're either players like Rita Zuhir, who's playing regularly in the Montreal first team setup, which is, you know, it's huge to see that. If not, they're guys who are playing in MLS Next Pro every week against players, you know, who are 22, 23, 24, some, you know, men as well. That's a huge difference. And you add in just the European academies, you look at some of these kids who are playing, you know, in these European setups. I think it's a good mix of, before it was just kind of, you put together 20 kids, you sent them down to wherever the tournament was, and you prayed they'd gel together. Maybe that you get one of a flash in the pan. Whereas you look now, you've got, you know, nearly 8, 9, 10 players, all with strong professional experience. You add in those flash in the pan wild cards who are playing in European academies, who are showing good things. I think it's such a good mix, and I think it's one of the deeper teams that Canada's had, and I think because of that, it's going to allow them to be more prepared. And I think the fact that they had a preparation camp, something that they hardly ever did, and back in April, and they went out against Costa Rica, won 3-0, and then lost 1-0 away with a team that had never played together before. That's a great sign. That's a, you know, Costa Rica is going to be one of the teams that's going to want to compete for those four spots in the U20 World Cup that are up for grabs. So I think it shows that this is just a start, because I imagine in 4 years when we do this again, if there's six CPL players now, there could be 12 CPL players. There could be more players playing in, you know, there, we think of Jesse Costa and Wolfsburg. There could be players be playing in all sorts of big European academies, more players playing in MLS. And I think that's good to have A, more of that professional experience, but B, most importantly, which I think has hurt Canada a lot at the youth levels, is that diversity of options, where it's not just, okay, who are the best 20 rated MLS kids that we have and put them together. No, it's you can look at the CPL, you can look at Europe, you can look at MLS Next Pro, and have a team that's not just, you know, it doesn't feel like it's handpicked beforehand. It actually felt like Canada had to make a decision on 20 players instead of just felt like the team was picked 3 months ago.
One thing you mentioned there, Alex, is preparation. And I know in the past, I mean, I played in the 87 under 20 World Cup, and it was, and we actually were regulars at the under 20s for the most part back in those days. Such an important tournament for experience wise as well. It put me in such a great stead as far as future tournaments and understanding tournament football for the first time, and the difference between that and club. But preparation has always been never great for Canada. I remember even Nick Dazovich, I think he was in charge of the U20 team, and, you know, you're up against the United States, who have been together for 3 months, basically in a camp, and you get your team for a few days. Some of the players you've never seen before because the coach can't afford to fly around and see these guys play. What chance have we actually got unless we actually prepare these players, you know, and if they're good enough technically, and it sounds as though they got a great squad, prepare them properly to give them a fair crack at actually qualifying, because the U20 event is a massive event that's important. And I think Argentina is probably the greatest example of that, how seriously they take it, the South Americans, Brazil and Argentina.
Well, it's a good point. And I think for me, we're talking about World Cup money, you know, we're talking about two of the most important things for me with that money beyond, you know, giving the play, all the players their due compensation. I say, number one, put it in the domestic leagues, you know, men and hopefully women soon, so we can continue to grow the pipeline. And number two has to be improving the youth setups. I think it would be great now if you want to really build things for the future. you know, have you 20 camps regularly, have you 16, you 15, you 17, and not just do it where it's okay, it's a tournament. Let's throw together a camp and go down and see how we do. Maybe we'll do all right. Maybe we'll get lucky. Maybe we'll have a golden generation. So I think that will be the next step for Canada in terms of consistently churning out youth talent is because I imagine, say, you know, you start at the U15s and there's kids who, you know, come up together, they play together in the CPL and MLS, et cetera. By the time they're 20, they're 21, they're playing on the first team. We don't have many of that. And I mean, it's kind of shows where Canada is at, where they've had all these dual nationals. I mean, there have been some like Alphonso Davies and Jonathan David who've been playing together since they're 14, but there haven't been many. But it's going to be great to see more of this youth development long term. And I think if you're Canada, that has to be a priority, and that's something that will benefit them greatly down the road, just, you know, regularly having these camps. So because just I think of the U20 World Cup, it's the fact that Canada hasn't been since 2007, it hurts so much because I imagine you look at, say, 2019 when the U.S. were there and how much having some of their players got them into the shop windows for Europe, for other things like that. I think of you look at some of the youngsters on this team, say they make it to the 2023 World Cup. I'll use an example that Jimmy is familiar with, Lowell Wright, someone who's I've seen a lot of great things from. Imagine he's still at the CPL next year. He goes and scores 5 goals in Indonesia at a tournament. What's that going to do for the CPL, for leagues around the world to be like, hey, there's this, you know, 20-year-old playing in the CPL who just scored 5 goals against some really good teams. Mm-hmm. Let's have a look at that league. Let's buy this player. And it just kind of creates a chain effect that you know, it's we've kind of seen missing from Canada because they've missed out on so many key events like this.
Yeah, great points, man. Alex, it was amazing to talk to you, buddy. I'm glad we finally got to do this. We'll definitely do this again. Thanks for joining us this morning, man.
It was awesome. Appreciate it a ton, guys.
Thanks, buddy.
Thanks, bud. That was great.
Alexandre Gongu-Ruzic from Vancouver. Yeah, a lot to be excited about. I wanted to bring that up, Jimmy, Lowell Wright on that team. Did they do a camp like at the start of the season and then they went back to their clubs?
Yeah, I think they did have a small camp. You know, and the good thing is, you know, Mauro, he's always in contact with all the coaches as well, finding out about the young players, getting a better understanding of what they're like, their character, what are they like off the field? What's a work ethic like? You know, are they the last one under the pitch and first one off? Or are they the type of player that's out there always looking to improve? And, so, you know, he does his homework and you got to give him an awful lot of credit of putting this team together, obviously with his staff. And, you know, when you look at it on paper, they're a good little team, a very good team. And I think what also happens is, well, now that we have this domestic league with CPL, and all these young guys coming through and playing, it gives the coaches an opportunity here to see the players play week in and week out. And it's always difficult trying to watch the players that are playing in academies over in Europe because a lot of the games aren't televised. You can't really see. You've got to go through a judgment with the coaches and have a talk with them and see how things are going. But, you know, with here, with MLS Pro and with the academy games here and the CPL teams, it makes it a lot easier for the coaches to keep tabs and eyes on all these young players because you get to see them week in and week out.
It's such a good point, man. And looking at this roster and seeing the makeup, you know, there's quite a few domestic based players. I think CF Montreal kind of leads the table here. But look at some of these teams that they're playing for. There's a center back at Bristol City, Jamie Knight-Labelle. And there's a player at Lazio, Wolfsburg, Freiburg. There's a Thiago Coimbra, great name. Forward at Palmeiras. Like, that's a lot to keep hold of if you're the coaching staff to watch these guys. And as you say, the opportunity to get together for more than a few days makes it very, very difficult when you're a country like this. But I agree with Alex, going forward, you're going to see that CPL number rise.
Yeah, you will. You talk about the kid at Bristol too. I mean, everybody that has any kind of Canadian background, they're all contacting the CSA too. So I was actually contacted by his agent in England, same agency as Paul Pesce-Salido works for, looking after this kid. His dad's a Canadian, and he, at this present moment, wants to play for Canada, but I think he qualifies as well for, I think, Wales as well. But yeah, is another one, you know, so you just keep an eye on these guys and see how they develop. But so far, that kid looks pretty
good.
You're
right. He did get called up for Wales, and I think he was about to go to the camp because we ended up talking to a few people at Bristol, and I think it was Brian Tinian, the academy director. He was the one that said Wales are having a sniff at him. And luckily for Canada, they went in quick and they got him, which is awesome.
Well, it is, but it doesn't hold him. It doesn't hold him. So.
But at least he's going to get a taste of it.
Yeah.
Right. And, you know, we always say, you know, when our national team's successful, everybody wants to be a part of success. And the way our team is looking right now, our national team going to a World Cup, how much we've improved as on a football side anyways, you know, you're starting to get these young kids now that are going, hey, I wouldn't mind playing for Canada. Look at Alfonso Davies and all these other players. And, you know, they're starting
and to play. And we've got the World Cup at 26, which is.
And we got the World Cup.
It's that nice little carrot to dangle in front of them.
Yeah. Because you're thinking, if you get in now, next number of years, if I'm playing week in and week out, I've got a great chance playing in the World Cup.
Yeah.
At home. So it's brilliant.
You know, they Jonathan Azoria was a part of that broadcast, for those that didn't see the city announcement. And when the host said, you know, what would it be like to be playing for a World Cup at home? And you can kind of see the thought flash. It was like, well, I'm 34. God, I hope I'm still going at that point to have that opportunity. And then Matthew Shinetti from TSN, he was at Real Sports for the celebration party. And Jaden Nelson and Jacob Schaffelberg were there, and he had them on. And, you know, you could see the realization. They were all there for the party and the celebration. But that's exactly the target. How, you know, unthinkable was that 10 years ago or when you guys were growing up that there would be games here? And these guys can actually see that as a tangible, you know, goal within reach. It's pretty incredible.
It is incredible. And it's also incredible when you look at a guy like Oso, who is in that, you know, that age limit now, and he's like, yeah, I'm going to be 34 when it whirls around. You know, that's a lifetime in football. It's a lifetime, several generations, but it's possible. Mm-hmm. That at 34 he still could be a part of it. Absolutely. So I mean, I guess obviously you got your eye on this particular World Cup and then you can worry about that later, but certainly some players right on the cusp age wise will be hoping to keep themselves
holding on for dear life, aren't you?
yeah get out there running every day.
Yeah.
Of course. Yeah. Well, when 42-year-old Cristiano Ronaldo is filling out Foxborough outside.
Oh, you had to bring up him again.
Of course. There's always some way.
Yeah.
There's always some way, guys. Anything else on the host announcements? I saw Charmin tweeting about what he would do if he was in charge of FIFA, how he would have run the show. And let's be honest, he doesn't know who the fuck Becky G was. He'd never heard of her before she came up and announced. Amazing Latino artist, by the way. Do you guys don't know who Becky G is?
Oh yeah, of course.
Big fan, eh? You love your reggaeton club pop.
You know, the only host city that I just don't understand is Boston with Foxborough.
Really?
It doesn't make
sense. Boston, though.
Doesn't make sense to me.
It's nowhere near Boston.
It's nowhere near, man.
But the idea that Boston, it, like, you're not having games in Vegas. You're not having games in Chicago. You're not having games in Washington. How can you not have a game in one of those cities? So they chose Boston.
But it's not. It's Foxborough.
It's Foxborough.
It's miles and miles and miles outside the city.
And you got to leave hours in advance because the traffic is absolutely shite.
It's a disaster to get there.
Yeah. It really is.
Yeah. But I mean, that's kind of the classic American stadium setup, right? It's like, even in Dallas, what's the distance between Dallas and AT&T Stadium? That can't be close either. It seems like in the middle of nowhere, a place where they have land and a place where they could sell parking spaces for $50 each and have 10,000 parking spaces. That was the American model from the 80s that got them the World Cup in 94. In Detroit, the USA 94 games were at the Pontiac Silverdome. They were growing grass outside. So you kept saying live grass, dead grass. I'm like, oh yeah, I guess that they grew it outside and then rolled it in on wheels. They grew it.
It was
outside.
Those octagons that they grew it on. Remember, they put them all together.
Yeah. No, it was wild. I think Italy played a game there at the Silverdome. But I mean, shit, that drive to Pontiac is horrible. That was a 45 1-hour drive through Michigan. So that's just kind of the American setup. But any other points? Edmonton,
if I was a World Cup fan, I'd be thinking Seattle, Vancouver. What a beautiful area. It's not too far away. You could catch a whole bunch of games in between those two places. Pretty nice setup.
No, it's smart, right? And it seemed quite clear that they were choosing these cities in pairings. So maybe you just don't like the idea that Toronto's pair is Boston, which doesn't seem that logical, but I mean.
Or New York.
Or Philly.
It's all close.
Yeah.
But I think they would pair.
An hour flight.
but they would pair New York with Philly, I think.
Yeah.
It's much, much closer. That leaves mm-hmm. Toronto and Boston as kind of the odd northern ones off. But I mean, Edmonton was totally isolated and totally alone, right? Regardless of what the Alberta government included there to make it more difficult for FIFA. You weren't going to pair them. Even with Denver would have been too far.
What will Toronto do? I mean, they're going to expand to 40, 45,000. Is it going to be temporary? Because I know Jimmy mentioned about, you know, just the size of that stadium. Are they going to sell it out? Do they want a stadium that big full time after the fact? Can TSC maintain it, or do they just fill those end zones kind of like they did for that MLS and Grey Cup final, didn't they? They put that one big end. You know, they can do that quite easily.
They did for the classic too, didn't they?
Yeah, yeah. So that's my guess is what they'll do.
Yeah, that seemed to be the rumor in the reporting was that it was going to be temporary standing, but they said not the scaffolding. So whether they, you know, I can think back to a few times that one end, Jimmy, before they put the Argos in there, there was like a what felt like, you know, a permanent stand there that then they've then removed and they've since added back. I think there's ways to do it that doesn't feel like that scaffolding standing that they use for the MLS Cup final. I can't see FIFA approving that. But no, whether I'm they sure hold it for more than a season.
Yeah, I'm sure they'll put a prefab structure in there that they can build, put together, and then take it elsewhere. Because you see that a lot of times where some stadiums, they're that prefab, and they use them, and then all of a sudden they pack them all up again, and they ship them somewhere else, or whoever else needs it.
Mm-hmm. That one in Qatar is pretty amazing. They built with all the it's just containers. The whole stadium's made of shipping containers.
Yeah.
Wild.
Fascinating. Really is.
Yeah. Yeah, wonder how many people died putting those shipping containers together without any cranes or anything. God,
Jesus,
that's a story for another day. I guess we can get into that another time if you want, guys. Get into that another time. If there's nothing else about 2026, then big news this side is the MLS have a brand new TV deal. I don't know if you guys hit this much on Wednesday's show, but a 10-year, $2.5 billion deal with Apple TV. That I just think, honestly, guys, is exceptional for the league. We've spoken before about their TV numbers not being great, but that access and exposure I think that this will bring domestically and internationally, because all of these games will be available on Apple TV anywhere. This isn't landlocked to Canada and the States. You can subscribe in whatever country you're in. And then domestically, which is new and the first, there's no blackouts. So you can finally watch any MLS game that you want wherever you are.
Mm-hmm. I think it's great. They bring in a bit of money. I mean, the only thing is for the soccer fan in Canada, just alone, you're looking at, all right, MLS, you need Apple, you need One Soccer for CPL, you need TSN for the World Cup, you need DAZN for Champions League. What am I missing? There's something else. Fubo for Premier League. There's five different things. What do you know, people can't afford. You know, we talk about ticket prices for soccer fans. It's a working class sport. You have five different platforms. You can't afford them all. So you got to pick and choose. Which one are you going to take? You know, that's.
Yeah. I would argue, though, that the only difference is that all of these are actually accessible now. Because if you look at 20 years ago, when you didn't have every Premier League game available, unless you paid the extra $20 a month for Setanta or Sportsnet World, then you had every Premier League game available. But you didn't have access to Serie A unless you were watching an Italian on whatever. So now that these games are available, a high production quality in English, right? Some people have to decide. I certainly will, and I've cut back on my cable bill for things that I wasn't watching. It wasn't worth paying the subscription for this one channel just because I wanted to watch El Clasico twice a season, right? Why am I paying the monthly for that? So you go without it. In general, you can find soccer. It's probably the most accessible sport for illegal streams if you wanted to pick and choose. But in terms of growing the sport, you're right. It's tricky that it's splintered. As a soccer community, we've always been fighting against this, especially in television, right? To get people to pay the premium to support. And the TV execs like know that and see that too. Oh, if Manchester United is the hot team, the hot property. Well, we're putting that on the subscription channel. I understand from a business decision why they do that. Mm-hmm. But also from growing up and not being able to access some of these other leagues, it's still amazing for the Canadian soccer fan, and there will be more because we can have access to these now. So much more.
Mm-hmm.
So
that's true.
Yep. Well said, Brendan.
Thanks, buddy.
I do feel like, though, that I've sucked the laughs out of this show today. You know, I may speak well, but this.
Oh, Jimmy was up till about 5 a.m. last night, so that's probably why he's a little quiet today.
What, did you go to the spa until 2 a.m? Did you go to the spa up there, Mark?
He had a facial.
Yeah. He's so stupid. Why?
Also, you guys, I didn't go to the spa last Wednesday this week. That was the Wednesday before. And everybody needs, you know, some relaxation, especially working with you louts.
Yeah.
Did you get your nails done and everything?
Me or Jimmy?
Brendan? Brendan, 100%.
No.
No. You got a little massage.
So you did get a
neck a bit stiff.
Yeah.
I have to try one of those facials.
I could set that up for you.
Nothing to do with Craig's facial experience. Yeah, nothing to do with that.
God,
all right, guys,
couldn't hurt me.
Well, hopefully, those of you that are not in Vancouver or Toronto still have reasons to celebrate. Still a lot of soccer to watch. Although I'm glad that this international break is over, and I'm not being surprised every day by, oh wait, this is a Nations League game that's somewhat appealing. And totally unpredictable. Like, if you're a regular gambler, I guess friendlies would always have been this way as well. But if you're a regular gambler, it's just a lottery. It's just chance.
Mm-hmm.
Who would have, you know, who's looking at that going, oh, Hungary 4-0 plus 3,500. Yeah, I'm doing that today. Yeah, Hungary is totally winning plus 3,500. Let's go.
Never.
No one's doing that.
No.
Well.
No. Tough to predict those games. Yeah, I wouldn't be gambling on those games. They're just too unpredictable. Kind of like horse racing, you know, the big gamblers in England, they the Gold Cup, you know, at Cheltenham. Mm-hmm. They'll go big on that because every horse wants to win. There's less chance of corruption in the race. So Harry used to give us tips. Harry Redknapp used to give us tips at the Gold Cup all the time. DeCanio put a bunch of money on one of the horses. He got tipped, and I think it's still running today.
What's the horse's name?
Brendan Dunlop? He was so pissed off at the Harry. Harry's like, it's a tip. He was so mad that he lost money because he thought it was a guarantee that Harry's tip was going to win.
it's a different culture in England, right? The horses are so big.
Oh, yeah.
And the dog races. You guys ever been to the dog races?
I used to go to the dogs all the time. It was amazing.
Bachelor party at Wimbledon. Is that the main one there? The Wimbledon dog track.
They used to be everywhere, like everywhere. There would be a couple in each little town. It was really really big, really big. But talk about corruption! Holy God!
Oh yeah, they'd feed them just before the race and.
Yeah.
Bet on number three. The thing was just had a full meal. Couldn't even run.
Yeah.
Oops.
Yeah. Oh, man. Good times. All right, guys. Well, have a good weekend, and we'll figure out some shit to talk about on Sunday's show. For those of you primers, thanks for listening. Keep following us on Twitter, footy_prime. And as Sharman always says, cheers for listening, and keep buying newspapers.
What up, Primers? JC here. Can't get enough of Footy Prime, the podcast? Why not head over to Footy Prime's YouTube? Head to youtube.com/footyprime for exclusive video content. Then make your way over to wearefootyprime.com for all things Footy Prime, including our official gear from Admiral and our One Ball Gin from Nickel 9 Distillery. And make sure to follow and subscribe across all platforms, from Twitter to Instagram to Facebook to TikTok. Footy Prime has got you covered for all things footy. Thanks so much for listening, and back to the show.